to disturb my wives. My wives were very disturbed with my drinking. We had long talks when I would sell her forebodings about telling her that men of genius conceive their best projects when drunk. That the most majestic constructions of philosophic thought were so derived. Charlie said last night that Bill made his living selling fast talk to slow-thinking people. He's trying to sell some of that to Lois right here, but you know she didn't buy that.
He said, by the time I had completed the course, I knew the law was not for me. The inviting maelstrom of Wall Street had me in its grip. Business and financial leaders were my heroes. Out of this alloy of drink and speculation, I commenced to forge the weapon that will one day turn its flight like a boomerang and all but cut me to ribbons. Living modestly, my wife and I saved $1,000. It went into certain securities, then cheap and rather unpopular. I rightly imagined that they would someday have a great rise. I failed to persuade my broker friends to send me out looking over factories at Manovich, but my wife and I decided to go anyway. I developed a theory that most people lost money in stocks through ignorance of markets. I discovered many more reasons later on. Bill became one of the first real investment counselors on Wall Street. He went to the time he's referring to was back in the 1920s. Stock market was on a roll. Just about everybody that dealt with stocks made money out of them. All you had to do is buy them, hold them a while, let them go up in price, sell them, take your profits, buy some more. And you only had to put down about 10% on margin, and everything was being done on speculation. Bill began to say, look, sooner or later this bubble's going to burst. Sooner or later we're going to have to start making our decisions based on fact rather than speculation. He went to the people that had the money, and he said, if you guys will back me financially, I'll go out and I'll actually visit these companies in person. I'll look at the company, I'll look at the plan, I'll examine their books, I'll talk to the employees, I'll write up reports and send them back into Wall Street, and we'll start making our decisions based on fact. They said, no, Bill, thank you. We don't need that kind of information. We're making about all the money we want to make anyhow. That being a good, hard-headed alcoholic, he said, to hell with them. We get a good idea, we're going to carry it through one way or the other. He said, to hell with them, I'll just go do it myself. So he and Lois, he says, we gave up our positions and off we roared on a motorcycle. The sidecar stuff with tent, blankets, a change of clothes, three huge volumes of a financial reference service. Our friends thought a lunacy commission should be appointed. Perhaps they were right. I had had some success in speculation, so we had a little money. But we once worked on a farm for a month to avoid drawing on our small capital. That was the last honest manual labor on my part for many a day. We covered the whole eastern United States in a year. They traveled up and down the eastern seaboard of the United States, visiting these large companies. He investigated approximately 100 companies that year. He said, at the end of it, my reports to Wall Street procured me a position there and the use of a large expense account. The exercise of an option brought in more money, leaving us with a profit of several thousand dollars for that year. Bill sent these reports back into Wall Street. The guys that had the money saw them and they said, oh yeah, man, this is great information. Immediately they put him on a payroll, gave him a large expense account. He exercised an option, made several thousand dollars. That was a lot of money back in the 1920s. It's a lot of money today, but certainly back in the 1920s. Now, Bill was from a little town up in Vermont called East Dorset. He had never really had anything before in his lifetime. But now here he is on Wall Street, got a great job, got a good expense account, making that money. The next statement he says, for the next few years, fortune threw money and applause my way. I had arrived. How many of us have done the same thing? Just literally worked our tails off. And finally, we became successful at whatever it is, and that great feeling, the moment of arrival. My judgment and ideas were followed by many to the tune of paper millions. The great boom of the late 20s was seething and swelling. Drink was taking an important, exhilarating part in my life. Bill doesn't know he's alcoholic. He just knows that he loves to drink. There was loud talk in the jazz places uptown. Everyone spending thousands and chattered in millions. Scoffers could scoff and be damned. I made a host of fair weather friends. Now we know as an alcoholic, his drinking is going to be progressive. It's going to start getting worse and worse as time goes by.
I love Bill's story because I can identify with this jazz places uptown. I was quite capable at one time making a lot of money. I did make a lot of money for a lot of people. Quite capable of losing a lot of money too, which I did that. I helped Charlie lose $138,000 one time. He wasn't too happy about that. But anyhow, when we were on a roll of making money, everybody chattered in thousands, talked about millions, and scoffers would be scoffing and be damned, but the jazz places uptown were wonderful. I love what went on there. And Bill was doing a good job, drinking good whiskey, living good. Boy, I can identify with that. But he said, my drinking assumed a more serious proportion. His drinking is becoming more serious. Now it was fun drinking to begin with now. Now it's becoming serious. My drinking assumed a more serious proportion, continuing all day and almost every night. The remonstrances of my friends terminated in a round. I became a lone wolf.
People begin to say to Bill, you're drinking too much. Bill, you need to cut back. Bill, you better slow down. He did the same thing that I and most of you did too. He said, well, to hell with them. I don't need them anyhow. Now he begins to operate on his own. He's become a lone wolf now.
He said there were many unhappy scenes in our sumptuous apartment. There had been no real infidelity. For loyalty to my wife helped at times, my extreme drunkenness kept me out of those scrapes. Now, I believed about everything Bill's ever wrote, but I'm not too sure about that comment. You know, Bill wrote that little book called As Bill Sees It. Well, Lois wrote one, too, called Lois Remembers. There's a bit of a difference between the two, you see. Let's go to page four.
Let's go over to page four, first paragraph.
He said, now Bill's doing good, drinking good whiskey, making a lot of money in the jazz places uptown. Things are good. But in page four, abruptly in October 1929, hell broke loose on the New York Stock Exchange. After one of those days of inferno, I wobbled from a hotel bar to a brokerage office. It was 8 o'clock, 5 hours after the market had closed. The ticker seal clattered. I was staring at an inch of tape which bore the inscription of XYZ32. It'd been 52 that morning. He said, I was finished, so were many friends. The papers reported men jumping to the death of towers of high finance. That disgusted me. I would not jump. I went back to the bar. He had a solution, didn't he? My friends had dropped several men since 10 o'clock, well, so what? Tomorrow was another day. And as I drank, that old fierce determination wind came back.
How many of us have done the same thing? We've come out of the jailhouse, the divorce court, the hospital. On the way home, we stop off in the bar and have a couple of drinks. And as the whiskey courses through our veins, we say, we'll show them. They're not going to treat us that way. And we're up and we're off and we're running again. That old fierce determination to win, to show them that we're just as good as they are.
He said, next morning, I telephoned a friend in Montreal. He had plenty of money left, and I thought I'd better go to Canada. Bill was a drunk. He wasn't stupid. He went where the money was, didn't he? We all know it's up here in Detroit and Canada anyhow. Even we down in the South know that. By the following spring, we were living in our accustomed style. I felt like Napoleon returning from Elba. No St. Helena for me. But drinking caught up with me again, and my generous friend had to let me go. This time we stayed broke.
Certainly we see the progression of the alcoholism.
He said, we went to live with my wife's parents. Now that's got to hurt a guy like Bill. He's got lots of ego, lots of pride, very a self-made man, but now he can't even make a living for his wife, so he's got to go live with his wife's parents. That's got to hurt a guy like Bill. He said, I found a job and lost the result of a brawl with a taxi driver. Mercifully, no one would guess that I would have no real employment for 5 years or hardly draw a sober breath. My wife began to work in a department store, coming home exhausted to find me drunk. I become an unwelcome hanger-on to brokerage places. Those places were built and made a lot of people a lot of money. He used to be welcomed. Now he's going down there, and they're saying to him, hey, Bill, come here. You don't look too good this morning. You don't smell too good either. Why don't you go down the street there and hang around someplace else? We don't want you hanging around here. And that's got to hurt a guy like Bill really bad.
Now we see him beginning to drink for another reason entirely. Liquor ceased to be a luxury. It became a necessity. We're not drinking for fun now. We're not drinking for excitement. We're now drinking because we absolutely have to drink in order to live. Bathtub gin, 2 bottles a day, and often 3 got to be routine. Sometimes a small deal would net a few $100s, and I would pay my bills at the bars and delicatessens. This went on endlessly, and I began to waken very early in the morning, shaking violently. A tumbler full of gin, followed by 6 bottles of beer, would be required if I were to eat any breakfast. Nevertheless, I still thought I could control the situation, and there were periods of sobriety which renewed my wife's hope. Remember last night, Dr. Silkworth said we really cannot differentiate the true from the false. To us, what we're doing is normal. We see Bill's life going to hell in a handbasket already. Come in. Come in.
That's a computer virus.
What do you know about that?
They're going to get worse now.
He said, gradually things got worse. The house was taken over by the mortgage holder. My mother-in-law died. My wife and father-in-law became ill. Then I got a promising business opportunity. Stocks were at the low point of 1932, and I had somehow formed a group to buy. I was to share generously in the profits. Then I went on a prodigious bender, and that chance vanished. That's a story within itself. The guys that had the money, they knew how good Bill was putting these deals, what was it, putting these deals together. So they went to him and they said, Bill, we got a deal that we would like to have you work on. And we think you can put it together, and we think you can make money for us and make a lot of money for yourself. Now the only thing is, you cannot drink. And Bill said, oh, don't worry about that drinking, I'm through with that drinking. And he began to put this deal together and worked on it for a matter of 2 or 3 months. And one night, just before it was to be successfully completed, they're sitting around in a hotel room, and somebody passes around a bottle of Applejack. This was back during the Prohibition days, homemade Applejack. And he came to Bill, and he said, no, thank you, I'm not drinking. And he went on by him. After a while, the bottle came back, and the guy next to him said, Bill, you don't understand what's in this bottle. Said, this Applejack is the finest Applejack in the world. It's called Jersey Lightning. You better have a drink of it. And Bill's mind said, I've never tasted any Jersey Lightning. And no more thought than that, he reached out, grabbed a bottle, took a drink, triggered the allergy, and blew the whole deal. Now, the importance in that statement lies within the next paragraph. He said, I woke up. This had to be stopped. I saw I could not take as much as one drink. I was through forever. You know, for the first time, he could really differentiate the true from the false. He trotted out his willpower, and he said, sick 'em, Will. We're through with that drinking. Before then, I'd written lots of sweet promises, but my wife happily observed that this time I meant business, and so I did. Let's see where he went on willpower.
I was just informed that that was a false alarm, so we won't have to worry about that for right now. We learned last night that every time we're going to quit drinking, and many of us have quit drinking, we pulled out the most useful tool that we had, and that was that willpower. It said, sick 'em, Will. We're through with that drinking. And I know that a lot of people in here probably made that same promise to themselves or other people. I'm not going to drink anymore. And when we made that promise, we were serious about that. At least I was. But what I didn't know, and what we learned last night, and I've got lots and lots of willpower. Haven't used much of it, but I got it. But when any time there's a battle going on between the willpower and the obsession of the mind will win out over willpower every time. Because it's stronger than our willpower. The obsession of the mind. And that's the lesson we learned last night. He said, shortly after it, I came home drunk. There had been no fight. What had been my high resolve? I simply didn't know. It hadn't even come to mind. Someone had pushed a drink my way and I'd taken it. Was I crazy? See, if your willpower don't work, you begin to question your sanity. Am I just crazy? Is that it? I began to wonder for such an appalling lack of perspective seemed near being just that. Now, renewing my resolve, I tried again. Some time passed, and confidence began to be replaced by cocksureness. I could laugh at the gin mills. Now I had what it takes. One day I walked into a cafe to telephone. In no time I was beating on the bar asking myself how it happened. As the whiskey rose to my head, I told myself I would manage better next time. But I might as well get good and drunk then than I did.
How many of us have done the same thing? Over and over and over.
The remorse and horror and hopelessness of the next morning are unforgettable. The courage to do battle was not there. My brain raced uncontrollably, and there was a terrible sense of impending calamity. Anybody ever have their brain raced uncontrollably? I did. For years. Not a week or two. For years. I hardly dared cross the street lest I collapse and be run down by an early morning truck. For it was scarcely daylight. An all-night place supplied me with a dozen glasses of ale. My writhing nerves were stilled at last. A morning paper told me the market had gone to hell again, but so had I. The market would recover, but I wouldn't. That was a hard thought. Should I kill myself? No, not now. Then a mental fog settled down. Gin fixed that. So two balls in oblivion. See, if a will power doesn't work, we begin to question our sanity, and that doesn't work. Then we begin to think about killing ourselves. Well, that doesn't work. So we begin to think about drinking for the sickest effect of all, which is total oblivion. As we all know, those of us who drink for oblivion, there's one thing wrong with it. You wake up and have to start all over again. And that's where we find Bill at this time.
The mind and body are marvelous mechanisms. For mine endured this agony 2 more years. Sometimes I stole from my wife's slender purse when the morning terror and madness were on me. Again, I swayed dizzily before an open window or the medicine cabinet where there was poison, cursing myself for a weakling. There were flights from city to country and back as my wife and I sought escape. Then came the night when the physical and mental torture was so hellish, I feared I would burst through my window sash and all. Somehow I managed to drag my mattress to the lower floor, lest I suddenly leap. A doctor came with a heavy sedative. Next day found me drinking both gin and sedative, and this combination soon landed me on the rocks. People feared for my sanity. So did I. I could eat little or nothing when drinking, and I was 40 pounds underweight. Now we see a guy who's dying from malnutrition. His calories that he's getting are from the alcohol. They are empty calories, none of the things necessary for life. And slowly, 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 he's beginning to die now from malnutrition. Without some help from other sources and other people, Bill probably wouldn't have lasted much longer. Next paragraph, he said, my brother-in-law, is a fellow named Dr. Leonard Strong, married to Bill's sister. My brother-in-law is a physician, and through his kindness and that of my mother, I was placed in a nationally known hospital for the mental and physical rehabilitation of alcoholics, the Towns Hospital, New York City, the summer of 1933. Under the so-called Belladonna treatment, my brain cleared. Belladonna was a drug that they used for withdrawal purposes. Today they use Valium and various other things. In those days it was called Belladonna. Hydrotherapy and mild exercise help much. Hydrotherapy deals with water treatment. I remember one time we were in Australia and we got into an old-style alcoholism treatment center. And there they had a shower room, and they had shower heads all the way around this room, and they would strap the alcoholic down on a gurney and roll him into that shower room and alternate hot and cold water. He'd be in there for about an hour. It doesn't cure alcoholism, but it sure as hell makes a clean drunk out of you. I know that. Said, best of all, I met a kind doctor, Dr. Silkworth, who explained that though certainly selfish and foolish, I'd been seriously ill, bodily and mentally. And Silky explained to Bill his ideas about the physical allergy and about the obsession of the mind. And Bill said it relieved me somewhat to learn that an alcoholic's the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor, though it often remains strong in other respects. My incredible behavior in the face of a desperate desire to stop was explained. Understanding myself now, I fared forth in high hope. For 3 or 4 months, the goose hung high. I went to town regularly and even made a little money. Surely this was the answer, self-knowledge. For the first time in his life, Bill understood what the problem was. He understood the physical allergy. He understood the obsession of the mind. And he thought, now that I know what's wrong with me, I'll not have to drink anymore. Let's see where he went on self-knowledge.
But it was not, for the frightful day came when I drank once more. The curve of my declining moral and bodily health fell off like a ski jump. After a time, I returned to the hospital.
Now it's the summer of 1934. He's been drinking again now for several months.
This was the finish, the curtain, it seemed to me. My weary and despairing wife was informed that all end with heart failure during delirium tremens. Oh, I would develop a wet brain perhaps within a year. She would soon have to give me over the undertaker or the asylum. Bill was laying in the hospital room again, detoxing from lots of drinks. And Lois and Dr. Silkworth standing in the doorway out there by the hall. And she asked Dr. Silkworth, said, Doc, do you think there's any hope for Bill this time? And he said, Lois, I don't think so. I don't think he's going to be able to come back this time. We have to give him over to the undertaker or the asylum because I don't think he has enough sense to come back. And look what Bill overheard this. He said, they did not need to tell me. I knew and almost welcomed the idea. See, you can't scare an alcoholic into staying sober. He knew what they were talking about and almost welcomed the idea. It was a devastating blow to my pride. I, who thought so well of myself and my abilities, of my capacity to surmount obstacles, was cornered at last. Now I was plunged into the dark, joining that endless possession solitude gone on before. I thought of my poor wife. There had been much happiness after all. What would I not give to make amends? But that was over now. See, we see Bill now. He's hopeless, helpless, powerless over alcohol. He knew he couldn't stay sober, and he knew he couldn't stay drunk, and he was a heck of a shape. So Bill is without hope. And we all know you can't live too long without hope. And as Bill was, he was hopeless.
Now let's look at this next paragraph very carefully. No words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. I've never seen a better description of step one. No step one written in those days. But this is where Bill took it. It's where he admitted absolute, complete defeat. Alcohol had become his master. Completely powerless over alcohol. Now, if that should happen to you and I today, chances are we'd say, well, that being the case, I guess I better go to AA. Bill didn't have any AA to go to. He's in the best treatment center he knows of. And even though he's admitted complete defeat, taking what we know today as step one, the only thing he can do is leave that hospital and try to stay sober. He said, trembling, I stepped from the hospital a broken man. Fear sobered me for a bit. Then came the insidious insanity of that first drink. And on Armistice Day 1934, I was off again. Everyone became resigned to the certainty that I would have to be shut up somewhere or would stumble along to a miserable end. How dark it is before the dawn. In reality, that was the beginning of my last debauch. I was soon to be catapulted in what I like to call the fourth dimension of existence. I was to know happiness, peace, and usefulness in a way of life that is incredibly more wonderful as time passes. Near the end of that bleak November, it was probably pretty bleak too, he took a drink on November the 11th. He'd been drunk now for about 3 weeks. I sat drinking in my kitchen. With a certain satisfaction, I reflected there was enough gin concealed about the house to carry me through that night and the next day. My wife was at work. I wondered whether I dared hide a full bottle of gin near the head of her bed. I would need it before daylight. My musing was interrupted by the telephone. The cheery voice of an old school friend asked if he might come over. This is the fellow named Ebbie Thatcher. And he was sober. If you'll notice, he was sober as in squiggly writing. When you see squiggly writing in the big book, it's usually something very, very important. Ebbie's calling Bill, and Ebbie's sober. It was years since I could remember his coming to New York in that condition. I was amazed. Rumor had it that he'd been committed for alcoholic insanity. I wondered how he had escaped.
Abby's family was a very prominent family in Albany, New York, and Abby's father was a mayor, and he was running for re-election, and Abby staying drunk all the time in public was embarrassing his campaign. So he called Abby in one day and said, "Abby, you're drinking and embarrassing the family and the campaign for my re-election, and I want you to get out of town, basically. I want you to go over to East Dorset, where we have a summer place, and I want you to stay over there until after the election, and maybe you can sober up while you're over there. If you can't sober up, at least fix up the summer place and clean it up and paint and do a few things around, make yourself useful. But try to stay sober." So Abby went over to East Dorset to stay sober and to help clean up the summer place. And one day he had been painting the side of the house, and he was standing back admiring his paint job. But he noticed some pigeons up under the eaves doing some things on the side of the wall that he didn't like. So he went in the house and got the shotgun and began to shoot at those pigeons, blowing a hole in the side of the house. Well, the neighbors don't like this. So they called the police and they arrested Abby, took him to jail, took him before the judge, and we're going to have him committed for alcoholic insanity. Well, Abby got real lucky here because he had two friends, two people that he knew of, interceded on his behalf. One of them was Roland Hazard and the other was Seabra Graves. Seabra Graves' father was a judge, Judge Graves, kind of a little slender thread here. And they asked the judge if they could release Abby to their care because Roland was staying sober and Seabra was staying sober, and the judge wanted to see if this Abby could stay sober. So they released Abby to their care. Abby began to go to the Oxford Group meetings with him. He applied the 12 tenets of the Oxford Group to his life, and he was staying sober. After about 3 months, he decided to go to New York and to live in the Calvary Mission, the headquarters of the Oxford Group in New York. And he was staying there in the Calvary Mission. And while there, he remembered his friend Bill, who was a drunk like he was. So he decided to go see Bill and see if he might help Bill stay sober as he was staying sober. He said, "I wonder how he escaped. Of course he would have dinner. We would have dinner, and then I could drink openly with him. Unmindful of his welfare, I thought only of recapturing the spirit of those other days. There was that time then we chartered an airplane to complete a jag. His coming was an oasis in this dreary desert of futility. The very thing, an oasis. Drinkers are just like that."
Said the door opened, and he stood there fresh-skinned and glowing. There was something about his eyes. He was inexplicably different. What had happened? I pushed a drink across the table, and he refused it. Disappointed but curious, I wondered what got into the fellow. He wasn't himself. "Come, what's all this about?" I queried. He looked straight at me. Simply but smilingly, he said, "I've got religion." Now, I'm damn glad that didn't happen in my kitchen. I have no idea what I would have done. But here's what old Bill did. He said I was aghast. So that was it. Last summer, an alcoholic crackpot. Now I suspected a little crack about religion. He had that starry-eyed look. Yeah, the old boy was on fire, all right. But bless his heart, let him rant. Besides, my gin would last longer than his preaching. But he did no ranting. In a matter-of-fact way, he told how two men had appeared in court persuading the judge to suspend his commitment. They had told of a simple religious idea,
which is step two,
and a practical program of action,
steps 3 through 12.
That was 2 months ago, and the result was self-evident. It worked. He had come to pass his experience along to me if I cared to have it. I was shocked but interested. Certainly I was interested. I had to be, for I was hopeless. Bill knew Abby. He knew how Abby drank. He used to drink with Abby. They were old school friends together. And he knew that if Abby had been sober for 2 months, some power greater than Abby had to be working in Bill's in Abby's life. So this made a great impression on Bill. He said he talked for hours. Childhood memories rose before me. I could almost hear the sound of the preacher's voice as I sat on still Sundays way over there on the hillside. There was that proffered temperance pledge I never signed. My grandfather's good nature, contempt of some church folk and their doings. His insistence that the spheres really had their music, but his denial of the preacher's right to tell him how he must listen. His fearlessness as he spoke of these things just before he died. These recollections welled up from the past. They made me swallow hard. Bill is having a hard time with this simple religious idea. Abby's sitting there talking about God. Bill didn't want to talk about God. Bill was raised primarily by his grandfather Griffith. And grandfather Griffith had always fallen out with organized religion. He denied anybody's right to tell him how he must listen. He believed in a God of some kind. He believed in spirituality. But he certainly had fallen out with organized religion. And Bill's ideas were exactly the same. Here's Abby, though, trying to present this religious idea to him. And Bill is interested, but he's not too crazy about it.
See, Bill had already took step one. We saw that where he took step one a few minutes ago. Now, Abby is presenting him with a solution, one that he didn't like. He was aghast at that solution. You see, he said, I was shocked, but interested. Certainly I was interested. I had to be, for I was hopeless. See, Bill took step one. And on pages 10 and 11, Bill has begun to question himself about this solution that Abby presented. And that's what he's doing on 10 and 11. He's wondering about this. His grandfather instilled within him the idea that the preacher couldn't tell him how he must listen. He began to question these ideas and thoughts, wondering. He's somewhere between step one, which he took, and step two, which he hasn't took yet. He's just wondering about it. I'd always believed in the power of greater than myself. I'd often pondered these things. I was not an atheist. Few people really are. For that means blind faith in the strange proposition that the universe originated in cipher and aimless and rushes nowhere. My intellectual heroes, the chemists, the astronomers, even the evolutionists suggested vast laws and forces at work. Despite contrary indications, I had little doubt that my purpose and rhythm underlay all. How could there be so much precise and immutable law and no intelligence? I simply had to believe in the spirit of the universe, who knew neither time nor limitation, but that was as far as I'd gone. With ministers in the world's religions, I parted right there. When they talked of a God personal to me, who was love, superhuman strength, and direction, I became irritated, and my mind snapped shut against such theories. And certainly I can identify with Bill. I was presented with that same message a number of times during my lifetime, and my mind snapped shut against such theories. And I would run those people off who would bring me that message. It had nothing to do with them.
On the top of page 11, he says, to Christ I conceded the certainty of a great man, not too closely followed by those who claimed him. His moral teaching most excellent. For myself, I'd adopted those parts which seemed convenient and not too difficult. The rest I disregarded. Anybody in here besides me identify with Bill Wilson? You betcha. Let's go down to the middle paragraph. But my friend sat before me, and he made the point-blank declaration that God had done for him what he could not do for himself. His human will had failed. Doctors had pronounced him incurable. Society was about to lock him up. Like myself, he had admitted complete defeat. Then he had, in effect, been raised from the dead, suddenly taken from the scrap heap to a level of life better than the best he had ever known. Had this power originated in him? Obviously it had not. There'd been no power in him than there was in me at that minute, and this was none at all. This is where the identification process is so important. Bill knew about Abby, and he knew how Abby drank, and he knew that if Abby had been sober 2 months, some power greater than Abby had to be working in Abby's life. Whether Bill likes it or not is absolutely beside the point. Abby's sitting there as living proof of it. That's what you and I have to offer when we go out and talk to a newcomer on a 12-step call. We're sitting there as living proof that some power greater than human power has worked in our lives also. Makes no difference whether the newcomer likes that idea or not. We are the proof of it. Abby was the proof of it to Bill. Let's go over on page 12. Bill still doesn't like this idea, even though we can see it in Abby.
He said, despite the living example of my friend, there remained in me the vestiges of my old prejudice. Prejudice means old ideas, by the way. He had a bunch of old ideas. The word God still aroused a certain antipathy. When the thought was expressed that there might be a God personal to me, this feeling was intensified. I didn't like the idea. I could go for such conceptions as creative intelligence, universal mind, or spirit of nature, but I resisted the thought of the Tsar of the heavens, however loving his sway might be. I have since talked to scores of men who felt the same way. In other words, Bill said, there's got to be a harder way to do this. What you're telling me is just too simple. I can't buy it. See, Abby was coming from the Oxford group, which was teaching first century Christianity. And Bill never could accept that idea. His mind snapped shut against such theories.
I'd like to have been there that day. You know, Bill's drunk. Been drunk now for about 3 weeks. And here's Abby, he is on fire coming out of the Oxford groups, trying to convince Bill of the need for God. And coming from the Oxford groups, the terms he used were all highly religious in nature. And we can see that Bill is having a hard, hard time with this religious idea. And I guess finally, Abby probably got tired of arguing with him. Let's look at the next statement very carefully. My friend suggested what then seemed a novel idea. He said, why don't you choose your own conception of God? And the instant he said that, his message went from a religious message to a spiritual message. Religion says this is the way you have to believe. Spirituality says it really doesn't make any difference how you believe. The only question is, are you willing to believe? Now then, we're not talking about religion. Now we have gone to spirituality. And here's the statement, here's the effect it had on Bill. That statement hit me hard. It melted the icy intellectual mountain whose shadow I'd lived and shivered many years. I stood in the sunlight at last. It took away all argument from him. When Abby said, why don't you choose your own conception of God? It was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more was required of me to make my beginning. I saw that growth could start from that point. Upon a foundation of complete willingness, I might build what I saw in my friend. Would I have it? Of course I would. Surely this is when Bill took step two. No step two written in those days. And here's where Bill came to believe that a power greater than himself could help him out. And he came to believe that based on the simple little idea of, why don't you choose your own conception of God? And I think the reason Bill was able to accept that, and the reason so many of we alcoholics have been able to accept that, is we've never had any problem with our own conception of anything. You betcha. Let us believe in God the way we want to believe in God, then that's an entirely different idea. And I'm the same way with Bill Wilson. You know, I never could believe the way the Baptist Church taught me to believe when I was a kid growing up. I just never could believe in that kind of God. But you let me have my own conception of God, then it's an entirely different idea.
See, I don't believe that Abby was smart enough to come up with that idea on his own. I think he came up with it out of total frustration with Bill. Because Abby was coming out of the Oxford group, which were teaching first century Christianity. They were teaching the letter of the law. Bill was schooled in the spirit by his grandfather of the law. And Bill couldn't accept that. Finally, like I say, Charlie said, Abby is talking to Bill, and Bill's about half drunk. And finally he has said to Bill, oh hell, Bill, believe whatever you want to. Tired of talking to you. I've had those conversations, so I know what he said. And out of that frustration, he said, why don't you choose your own conception? And that idea opened the door for literally hundreds and thousands of us alcoholics along the way. But it wouldn't have been anything, wisdom on his part. It was out of total frustration. Believe whatever you want to.
He said, upon a foundation of complete willingness, I might build what I saw in my friend. Would I have it? Of course I would. Now, this is Bill's first reference to a wonderfully effective spiritual structure. And he's going to start painting a picture in our mind about this spiritual structure. And eventually he's going to talk about where we pass through that structure to freedom. Now the foundation of that structure is willingness. Willingness comes from step one. It's only when we can see that what we're trying to do is no longer going to work, when we can admit complete powerlessness over alcohol, then we become willing to change. So the foundation of this spiritual structure that we're going to build is willingness. A little later on, we'll see where the cornerstone of it is believing. And later on, we're going to talk about the keystone of this structure. And as we go through the book, we'll be referring to this and painting the picture in our mind of the spiritual structure. Now, Abby immediately began to take Bill to Oxford group meetings. But remember, Bill's already drinking. The allergies got him, and he can't get stopped. Eventually, he has to be placed back in the town hospital for the third time. And about December the 12th or 13th, they put him back in the towns. Dr. Silkworth withdrew him. Abby came to see him. They began to apply the little program of action in Bill's life to the best of their ability. We've already seen him take step one. We've seen him take step two. Let's see if we can't see the last 10 steps in the Oxford group program on page 13. He said, at the hospital, I was separated from alcohol for the last time. Treatment seemed wise, for I showed signs of delirium tremens.
He said, there I humbly offered myself to God that I then understood him to do with me as he would. I placed myself unreservedly under his care and direction. I admitted for the first time that of myself I was nothing. Without him I was lost.
The first tenet or the first step of the Oxford groups was surrender. And Bill knew later on that no self-respecting alcoholic is ever going to want to surrender. So he changed that to made a decision. Here when he says, I humbly offered myself to God, as I then understood him to do with me as he would. I placed myself unreservedly under his care and direction. We see Bill taking what we know today as step three. It was their first step in the Oxford group.
He said, I ruthlessly faced my sins.
Their next step or next tenet was examine your sins. And Bill knew no self-respecting alcoholic would do that. So later on, he changed it to make a searching and fearless moral inventory. There we see him taking what we know today as step four.
And became willing to have a newfound friend take them away root and branch. I've not had a drink since.
Became willing to have my newfound friend take them away root and branch. You notice friend is capitalized. He's referring to God. And here he's dealing with what we know today as steps six and seven. We're entirely ready to have God remove these character defects and then humbly ask him to do so. So there we see him taking steps six and seven.
My schoolmate visited me and I fully acquainted him with my problems and deficiencies.
They had a step called confession and sharing. And Bill knew no self-respecting alcoholic would ever do that. So he changed that to admit it to God, to ourselves, and another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. There he's taking step five with Abby.
We made a list of people I had hurt and toward whom I felt resentment. I expressed my entire willingness to approach these individuals admitting my wrong. Never was I to be critical of them. I was to right all such matters to the utmost of my ability.
The Oxford groupers had a step that was called restitution. And Bill didn't like the word restitution. And no alcoholic likes the word restitution. So Bill took that step and made two steps out of it, steps eight and nine, where we made the list and become willing to the list, and then we made the amends wherever possible. So there we're dealing with steps eight and nine.
I was to test my thinking by the new God conscious within. Common sense would thus become uncommon sense.
It's got to be step 10, where we continue to take personal inventory.
I would sit quietly when in doubt, asking only for direction and strength to meet my problems as he would have me. Never was I to pray for myself, except as my request bore on my usefulness to others. Then only might I expect to receive, but that would be in great measure.
That's got to be step 11, where we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, so on and so forth. There we're taking step 11.
My friend promised when these things were done that I'd enter upon a new relationship with my Creator, that I would have the elements of a way of living which answered all my problems.
It's got to be the first part of step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. So we see Bill in the town hospital using the Oxford Group Program of Action. And then later, in 1938, when he wrote the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, he simply expanded on them and put them in terms that we alcoholics could accept. Got them out of the religious into the spiritual.
He said, belief in the power of God, plus enough willingness, honesty, and humility to establish and maintain a new order of things were essential requirements. Now, these were simple, but not easy. A price had to be paid. It meant the destruction of self-centeredness. I must turn in all things to the Father Light who presides over us all. Poor alcoholic has to give up the two most important things in our lives. And the first thing is our alcohol, and the second thing is our self-centeredness, those things that we love so well.
Very simple, but very difficult to do. He said these were revolutionary and drastic proposals. But the moment I fully accepted them, the effect was electric. There was a sense of victory followed by such a peace and serenity as I'd never known. There was utter confidence. I felt lifted up as though the great clean wind of a mountaintop blew through and through. God comes to most men gradually, but His impact on me was sudden and profound. Now, Bill thought he was going nuts. He said, for a moment I was alarmed and called my friend the doctor, Dr. Silkworth, to ask if I were still sane. And he listened in wonder as I talked. Finally, he shook his head saying, something has happened to you. I don't understand. But you'd better hang on to it. Anything is better than the way you were. The good doctor now sees many men who have such experiences. He knows that they are real. While laying in the hospital, the thought came that there were thousands of helpless alcoholics who might be glad to have what had been so freely given me. Perhaps I could help some of them. They, in turn, might work with others. There is the middle part of step 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics. There's the middle part of step 12. My friend, you notice it's a small F this time, you're referring to Ebby. My friend had emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all of my affairs. There's the last part of step 12, where we tried to practice these principles in all our affairs. Particularly what is imperative to work with others as he had worked with me. Faith without works was dead, he said. And how appallingly true for the alcoholic. For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. If he did not work, he would surely drink again. And if he drank, he would surely die. Then faith would be dead indeed. With us, it is just like that.
So Bill went into that town's hospital very drunk. Person looked like he was going to go into DT. Something very profound happened to Bill. That great white light that he always talked about happened. He had a spiritual awakening as a result of those steps. A lot of people have asked Charlie and I, how long should you be sober before you work the steps? Bill says he was in there 2 or 3 days and he worked the steps. Dr. Bob came home after the first day of sobriety. He'd been out making amends. How long should you be sober before you work the steps? The question is, how long do you want to be sick? We can do them as best we can right away. And nobody that I know of ever done them perfectly, and I haven't, nobody else has. We can always improve on them as time goes by. But we do the best we can as soon as we can. We talked last night, the restless, irritability, resentment, and anger, those things got to be dealt with as quickly as possible. Otherwise, we might go back to drinking. So Bill had that great spiritual experience. He was in listening to Lois and Bill, Dr. Silkworth talk outside the hospital room. He said, is there any hope for him? He said, no, there isn't this time, Lois. I don't think he can come back. Bill had that experience. He called the doctor. He said, am I crazy? Have I gone nuts? Is that it? The doctor said, Bill, I don't know what's happened to it, but you better hang on to it. Anything's better than the way you were. The great doctor sees many people like that today.
I love this next paragraph. Yeah. My wife and I abandoned ourselves with enthusiasm to the idea of helping other alcoholics as a solution of their problem, to a solution of their problems. It was fortunate, for my old business associates remained skeptical for a year and a half, during which I found little work. I was not too well at the time, and was plagued by waves of self-pity and resentment. This sometimes nearly drove me back to drink. But I soon found that when all other measures failed, work with another alcoholic would save the day. Many times I've gone to my old hospital in despair. And talking to a man there, I would be amazingly lifted up and set on my feet. It is a design for living that works in rough going. You know, when Bill went to see Dr. Bob, he didn't go there to sober up Dr. Bob. He went there to keep Bill Wilson from getting drunk. And the reason he went there is he remembered how back in New York City, every time he had tried to help another alcoholic, even though he hadn't helped them, he himself had felt better. So carrying this message to other alcoholics is very essential for our long-term sobriety and our recovery from alcoholism.
The work is very, very hard, but the pay is good. See?
Now, if we've read and studied Bill's story, if we've been able to identify with Bill as another alcoholic, certainly we've been able to see the progression of his alcoholism as he goes through year after year after year after year. Certainly we've been able to see that he finally learned what his problem was through Dr. Silkworth. Surely we've been able to see that he thought, now that I know what's wrong with me, I won't have to drink any more. Self-knowledge will fix me. Surely we've been able to see that self-knowledge didn't fix him, because the old obsession of the mind took him right back to drinking again. We were able to see him going back in the town's hospital a year later, and this time he was pronounced incurable. And fear sobered him up for a bit. The fear didn't last any longer than self-knowledge did, and he started drinking again. And then Abby comes to see him with this little program of action, this little solution, the vital spiritual experience, what was referred to as a religious idea, which later changed to a spiritual idea. Surely we've been able to see him in the town's hospital for the third time, using the program of action from the Oxford groups, which later in 1938, when he wrote the 12 steps, he expanded into that last 10 steps of the Oxford groups. Surely we've been able to see him affect a recovery from alcoholism. And if we're brand new, we've never had any contact with the fellowship, the first contact is through the Big Book. And we've been able to identify with Bill all the way through this thing, and we see him affect a recovery from alcoholism, then surely we begin to believe that just maybe, I'm enough guy like this guy, that if he could recover, just maybe I could too. The beginning of belief, the beginning of hope, starts right here with Bill's story. And every newcomer I work with, I insist that they read Bill's story very, very carefully. And I ask them to underline everything in Bill's story that they can identify with. And it's absolutely amazing how much they underline when they're really looking for identification. So we see him affect a recovery. So now then, we not only know the problem, but we have an example of a guy that had the problem. And we have an example of the guy who recovered from that problem. So he's very, very definitely explained to us in the doctor's opinion and Bill's story what the problem really is. Not willpower, not moral character, not sin, but an actual illness, a twofold illness, an illness of the body as well as an illness of the mind that you can recover from. through his story.
Bill got his problem from Dr. Silkworth, the doctor's opinion. Abby shows up with a solution. Bill was aghast, that solution. Chapter 2, now Bill is going to present us with a solution. And a lot of us are going to be aghast at that solution too. You see, I had a friend of mine that was a guy that I sponsored for 22 years. He's dead now, but his name was Harold. And Harold said, Joe, there's as many solutions as there are people in AA. And I said, no, Harold, there isn't. Look at the chapter heading on chapter 2 and see how many solutions there are. There is a solution, only one solution, but are many different powers in AA, which we'll talk about in a minute, but only one solution. He said, we.
Let's go to page 17 now, chapter 2, and let's start looking at the solution to the problem of alcoholism.
We of Alcoholics Anonymous know thousands of men and women who were once just hopeless as Bill. Nearly all have recovered. They have solved the drink problem. Said we're average Americans. Today we're average citizens of the world. Because in Toronto this year they said that AA was in 190 countries around the world. So we're average citizens of the world today. All sections of this country, many of its occupations are represented, as well as many political, economic, social, and religious backgrounds. We're people who would normally not mix. And certainly that's true. As I look around the room here today, I'd say we were people who normally would not mix. We're probably the most mixed up group of people in Detroit here this morning. But there exists among us a fellowship, a friendliness, and an understanding which is indescribably wonderful. And you felt it before the meeting started. The power of the fellowship. There's a lot of power here in the fellowship. The laughing, the joking, the rubbing up against, the telling stories. That's the power of the fellowship. And I got sober on the power of the fellowship. That's all I had. Going to meetings. I felt good when I was in the meetings.
And here he's talking about the power of the fellowship. And he's going to use an example of something we already know about, in order to teach us what he wants us to know. All great writers have done this. And he's going to describe the feeling that we have for each other in our fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous by talking about the passengers of a great liner. He said, we are like the passengers of a great liner the moment after rescue from shipwreck. When camaraderie, joyousness, and democracy pervade the vessel from steerage to captain's table. You know, back in when Bill wrote this book in the 30s, your mode of travel from one continent to another was on the great ocean liners, long before air travel really became very popular. And on those great ocean liners, you had a very distinct class system. The immigrant people coming from Europe, most of them didn't have very much money coming to the States. So they rode in what they called a steerage section. The steerage section's way down in the bowels of the ship. Very little fresh air. Dormitory style living. Food not too good. I call it the cheese sandwich section. But it didn't cost very much money to ride in the steerage section. If you wanted better accommodations, you could spend a little more money and come up to the third class section. The accommodations were a little bit better, more fresh air, and probably a little ham on the cheese once in a while in the third class section. If you wanted something better, you could spend more money and come into the second class section. But then if you wanted to ride in the best section of the ship, you could spend enough money and ride in the first class section. Nice staterooms, good dining rooms, continual fresh air, good food, good waiters, good service, and good everything. But that still was not considered to be the elite place on the ship. If you had the right kind of money.
Old money, no new money.
If you had the right religion, if you had the right ethnic background, if you had the right everything, you might be invited to dine at the captain's table. Now, the captain's table had the best waiters, the best food, the best everything, and only the elite members got to dine at the captain's table. A long ways from the steerage section to the captain's table. And these people on a journey across the ocean from the steerage section to the captain's table would never have met each other. In fact, they even had separate stairwells on those ships so they couldn't meet accidentally. I'm sure he's referring now to the Titanic. Still fresh on everybody's mind at that time he wrote this book. And the night the Titanic hit the iceberg, and it began to sink. And some of these people from the steerage section, the second class, third class, they managed to make it up to the upper decks. Now here's two guys standing at the railing on the upper deck. This guy is from the captain's table. And he's got on his tuxedo, he's got his tie, his jewelry. He is dressed to the nines. Here's a guy standing beside him that made his way up out of the steerage section. Got his old work overalls on, his old Brogan shoes. Doesn't look very good at all. They're standing there side by side. They have nothing in common with each other until they jump overboard. And when their butts hit that cold water, they had something in common. How in the hell do we save ourselves? And they grabbed onto anything they could that would float. And later on, when they were rescued and they were back on another ship or were back on land, there was a feeling amongst them which is indescribably wonderful. You know, one of the greatest feelings one human being can have for another is if we escape from a common peril and both of us have been successful in that escape and there is a feeling amongst us which is indescribably wonderful. The book says, unlike the feeling of the ship's passengers, however, our joy in escape from disaster does not subside as we go our individual ways. When they got back onto that other ship or back on the shore, they were saved from the catastrophe. They probably looked at each other and they said, you know, we really don't belong together. And the guy from the steerage section, he went his way. The guy from the captain's table went his way, probably never to meet again. So they lost that feeling when they separated and went their various different ways. But our escape from disaster is always there. Alcohol's just outside the door waiting for us all the time. And our feeling that we have for each other, the feeling that having escaped from the common peril, is one of the powerful elements in the cement which binds us together. Lots of power in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. One alcoholic helping another alcoholic, and we help the newcomer, and et cetera, and et cetera, and et cetera. And he says, the feeling of having shared as a common peril is one element in the powerful cement which binds us. But now he warns us. But that in itself would never have held us together as we are now joined. In other words, the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, lots of power in it. But that in itself will never hold us together as we are now joined. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. Not the news of the fellowship, but the news of the common solution. And later on we're going to see the common solution is that vital spiritual experience or spiritual awakening. The fellowship supports us. The common solution, the vital spiritual experience, changes us. And we become entirely different people. So for those of us who are powerless, which is all of us, the solution is going to lie within power. And on page 17, he talks about two powers. The power of the fellowship that supports us. The power of the common solution, which changes us. And he very definitely makes it clear that the power of the fellowship alone is not sufficient. I think one of the greatest tragedies I see in the world today, and my God, there's tragedies all over the world today. One of the greatest I see is that we people who are members of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, we are spending hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars, hundreds and hundreds of men and women work hours, trying to attract other alcoholics to the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous when we've got thousands and thousands and thousands who are already members of AA who are sitting around in AA dying from untreated alcoholism because they're participating in fellowship only. They're doing nothing about the common solution. And eventually they go back to drinking again. And eventually they die from alcoholism. You know, I think it's one of our responsibilities as older members of AA to talk to the newcomer and make sure the newcomer understands, you betcha we can't exist without this fellowship. But you're going to have to do more than just be a member of AA. You're going to have to follow a little program of action. Well, eventually will lead to the spiritual experience or spiritual awakening, and that will cause you to change, and then you will recover from alcoholism. A good book never tells you anything, but what it doesn't back it up with more information. He's just told us that the fellowship alone is not sufficient. He's going to spend the first half of this chapter explaining to you and I why fellowship alone is not sufficient. He'll spend the last half of this chapter explaining to us what the common solution really is. And I think it's about time for us to take about a 15 or 20 minute break. Then we'll come back and we'll look at these two powers. Try to be back by about a quarter till if you can. And he asked his dad if he could get a bicycle for his birthday. And his dad said, "No, son, I'm sorry." He said, "You got four or five brothers and sisters. I can just barely buy food. No way can I afford to get you a bicycle." The little boy said, "Well, what could I do about it?" And his father said, "Well, why don't you write a letter to God and see? You never know what's going to happen." So he goes back to his bedroom and sits down at his desk and get a pencil and a piece of paper. And he began to write, and he said, "Dear Jesus, I'm a little Catholic boy. I'm 13 years old. I've never had a bicycle." He said, "Oh, shit, that won't work." And he tore it up and threw it away. And he sat there for a little while, and he got a piece of paper, and he started to write, and he said, "Dear God, I'm a 13-year-old Catholic boy, and I've always been active in church." And he said, "The hell, that won't work." And he tore it up and threw it away. And while sitting there, he happened to look up on the dresser, and there was a statuette of the Virgin up there. And suddenly his eyes lit up, and he jumped up, and he grabbed the statuette, opened up his underwear drawer, got out a roll of socks, put the statuette inside the roll of socks, put them back in the underwear drawer, way back in the back, and covered them up completely. Sat down at his desk and got the pencil and a piece of paper, and he said, "Dear Jesus, if you ever want to see your mama again..." I'll bet he was one of us, don't you? Okay. Two powers. The power of the fellowship that supports us. The power of the vital spiritual experience, which changes us. And those of us who are powerless, if we can get those two powers in our life, then maybe we could recover from alcoholism as Bill Wilson did. In the first half of the chapter now, he's going to explain to us why fellowship alone is not sufficient to recover from alcoholism. Joe?
So let's go on page 20 and let's see about the first half of this chapter where the fellowship supports us. And it says on page 20, you may already have asked yourself why it is that all of us became so very ill from drinking. Doubtless you are curious to discover how and why, in face of expert opinion to the contrary, we have recovered from a hopeless condition of mind and body. Now, if you're an alcoholic who wants to get over it, you may already be asking, "Well, what do I have to do?" Well, it's the purpose of this book to answer such questions specifically. Remember last night we talked about precisely, specifically, with clear-cut directions? Well, here's one of those words, specifically. We'll tell you what we've done. Before going into detailed discussion, it may be well to summarize some points as we see them. How many times people have said to us, "I can take it or leave it alone, why can't he?" why don't you drink like a gentleman or quit? That fella can't handle his liquor. Why don't you try beer and wine and lay off the hard stuff? His willpower must be weak. He could stop if he wanted to. She's such a sweet girl, I should think he'd stop for her sake. The doctor told him that if he ever drank again, it would kill him. But there he is, all lit up again. Now, these are commonplace observations on drinkers which we hear all the time. Back of them is a world of ignorance and misunderstanding. We see that these expressions refer to people whose reactions are very different from ours. And all those expressions come from people who don't drink. They're observations of us. Of course, we just kept on drinking. He said, back of them is a world of ignorance, and certainly it is. A lot of people today would have us believe that we're into denial. I've never been into denial, but I've been into ignorance most of my life, I'll tell you that. I didn't know that I didn't know. Where would I have learned these things from? Nobody told me about them, so I didn't know. I was uninformed, so to speak, if you will.
Now, he's getting ready to describe two kinds of drinkers that these expressions that Joe just read would refer to. First one, moderate drinkers have little trouble in giving up entirely. If they have a good reason for it, they can take it or leave it alone. Remember, we talked to them about them last night? They have a couple of drinks. They get a slightly tipsy, out of control, beginnings of a nauseous feeling. Alcohol is no big deal to them. They can take it or they can leave it alone. They choose when they drink, where they drink, how much they drink, and etc. Those observations would probably refer to a moderate drinker. Then we have a certain type of hard drinker. He may have the habit badly enough to gradually impair him physically and mentally. It may cause him to die a few years before his time. If a sufficiently strong reason, ill health, folly, good love, change of environment, or the warning of a doctor becomes operative, this man can also stop or moderate, although he may find it difficult and troublesome and may even need medical attention. We call this guy the heavy or the hard drinker. They drink quite like we alcoholics do, but they're not alcoholic. If a good enough reason presents itself to them, they'll usually do one of two things. They may learn to moderate their drinking. They do not have the physical allergy to alcohol. They may quit drinking entirely. They do not have the obsession of the mind for alcohol that we alcoholics have. They drink like us, but they're non-alcoholic. And you and I see them all the time. They're the ones that said, when I was in the service, I was an alcoholic also. And I got out of the service and got married and went to church, and I quit drinking, and I don't see why you can't quit drinking. They drink like us, but they're not alcoholics. They're heavy or they're hard drinkers. In my family, there's three boys. I'm the baby of the family. I've got an older brother who's about 9 years older than I am. 15 years after I came to AA, he finally came into AA also and recovered from alcoholism. There is a middle brother who drank as much as I ever drank, just as hard and just as often. I would have sworn that he was alcoholic. One day the doctor said to him, Bob, if you don't stop drinking alcohol, your blood pressure is going to kill you. You're going to end up with a stroke. And he just quit drinking. Now, once in a while, they'll go out and have a spaghetti dinner, and he'll drink a glass of wine. They may go have pizza, and he may drink a glass of beer. He drank exactly like I drank, like the older brother drank, but a good enough reason presented itself to him, and he was able to not only moderate his drinking, he was able to stop drinking entirely. He was a heavy or a hard drinker. He was non-alcoholic. And we see lots of them around from time to time. But what about the real alcoholic? He may start off as a moderate drinker. Many of us did. He may or may not become a continuous hard drinker. Many of us stayed periodic. But at some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts to drink. Now, here's the fellow who's been puzzling you, especially in his lack of control. Now, we're going to see a description of the real alcoholic on page 21 and into page 22. And when you see one that matches you, will you please raise your hand? We'd like to see if we're in a room full of real alcoholics, Joe.
He said about some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts to drink. Charlie talked last night about the people crossing over that line into alcoholism. Well, I don't know what line he was talking about, but I was drunk when I went over it, I can tell you that. Now, here's a fellow who's been puzzling you, especially in his lack of control. He does absurd, incredible, tragic things while drinking.
He's a real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Anybody like that in here?
See, I get good looking and out of debt just like that.
I have a couple of drinks and I look just like old Lee, that big taper sitting over here, every time I have a couple of drinks. Lee, are you over there?
Yeah.
Stand up where they can see you. Stand up.
Yeah, stand up, really.
Come on.
Yeah, wouldn't it?
I'd have a couple of drinks and I'd look just like him every time.
Yeah, I met Lee about 10 or 12 years ago and I said, I know you from somewhere. And this went on for 5 or 6 years. What did we know each other from? Back and forth. Finally, it's Oreo. Now I know. He said, what's that? I have 4 or 5 drinks. I look just like you. I know you well. Now, if alcohol would do that for you, me, why would you want to give it up? I get good looking and out of debt. Just like that.
Okay, more description. He is seldom mildly intoxicated. He's always more or less insanely drunk. Anybody like that in here? Yeah.
His disposition while drinking resembles his normal nature, but little. Anybody like that?
He may be one of the finest fellows in the world, yet let him drink for a day and he frequently becomes disgustingly and even dangerously antisocial. Anybody like that in here? Mm-hmm. You betcha.
He has a positive genius for getting...